is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, June 3, 2003. From WBAI in New York, I'm Deepa Fernandez. Where are the weapons of mass destruction? More voices demanding an answer. The Bush administration is coming up short. Bush meets with Arab leaders in Egypt as pro-war hawk attempts to play peacemaker. And in Nigeria, as a woman faces her final appeal of a sentence of death by stoning, in New York City, yet another case of police brutality has the black community outraged. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Protests and a general strike called by the political opposition party in Zimbabwe, who are against the government of President Robert Mugabe, enter a second day. The opposition party says it is determined to continue strikes and anti-government protests despite reported police and military brutality against the protesters. They want President Mugabe to step down, accusing him of using undemocratic means to hold on to power. Zimbabwean officials declare the law and a court order are on their side and demand the opposition party to cease in their illegal mass action. Today, a group of progressive African-American organizations, including Africa Action, the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists, and the Black Radical Congress, wrote a letter to Mugabe opposing what they call the oppressiveness of the government and ask Zimbabwe's leader to immediately and unconditionally meet to negotiate a peaceful solution to what they are calling a national crisis. They are also asking Mugabe to accept Nigerian, South African, and African Union officials to help mediate. Free Speech Radio News correspondent Sam Olokoya, in part, prepared this report. Labor groups have unleashed a new wave of strikes in France in response to reform plans announced by the country's conservative government. Jordan Davis reports from Paris.
Signs of today's labor mobilization are everywhere. Public transportation has been crippled, postal services interrupted, and hundreds of thousands of workers are marching in major cities. The touchy issue of pension reform is quickly turning into a standoff between unions and the government. Workers say that the government's proposal would force them to work longer in exchange for smaller retirement checks. Prime Minister Jean-Pierre Raffarin shut out union criticisms this afternoon, announcing that the time for debate and dialogue was over. He's expected to send the bill to the National Assembly next week. A number of unions have announced they will extend their walkout tomorrow. But the government did back down today on introducing a plan to decentralize the country's educational system. Final exams in some universities have been interrupted following a series of actions by students and teachers. For the time being, public opinion has been sympathetic to union demands on both retirements and education. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Jordan Davis in Paris.
Texas Governor Rick Perry signed off on a bill today that would release 14 citizens of Tulia, Texas, from prison. The predominantly black prisoners were arrested, along with 32 others, on the basis of a narcotics officer's discredited testimony. Kadam Saeed reports from KPFT in Houston.
Thanks to a Texas Senate bill, 14 remaining Tulia, Texas, prisoners will be released on bail in approximately 2 weeks. Governor Rick Perry signed off on the bill today. 46 Tulia residents, over 10% of the population, were arrested in 2000 for allegedly selling cocaine. 38 of those arrests were solely based on the faulty testimony of undercover officer Tom Coleman. Coleman never wore a mic during the alleged cocaine deals and proved unable to physically describe some of the defendants. Upon arrest of the 46 accused, police found no narcotics or weapons. Coleman was indicted for 3 counts of aggravated perjury in April. For Free Speech Radio News, from KPFT in Houston, I'm Kadam Saeed.
An internal report released by the Department of Justice found significant problems with the means the DOJ used to detain more than 750 undocumented immigrants after the September 11th attacks on the U.S. and with their treatment while they were in custody. Laura Doggett has more from D.C.
More than 750 immigrants were detained without access to lawyers or their families shortly after the September 11th attacks, and many waited weeks before being told why they were being held. The internal report issued by the Department of Justice says the FBI was anxious to arrest the immigrants and did little to sort out those connected to terrorist activity. Once they were in custody, the people were held an average of 80 days and were confined to maximum security cells. Nancy Chang of the Center for Constitutional Rights says they were treated like the worst criminals.
Those in the Metropolitan Detention Center were kept under bright lights 24 hours a day, often not allowed to leave their prison cell except for perhaps 1 hour a day. And when they were allowed to leave, they were manacled with not only handcuffs but also chains on their legs and chains keeping their hands to their waist.
None of the detainees have been charged as terrorists, and most have now been deported. The Department of Justice says they will make some procedural changes, but makes no apologies for the detention and no promises that under specific circumstances it will not happen again. Laura Doggett in D.C. for Free Speech Radio News.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
The former civilian head of the U.S. Army, Thomas White, who was recently fired after highly publicized feuds with Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, has said the Army needs to fess up and admit that the occupation of Iraq will require a major commitment of American troops. It's reported that White said in an interview that senior defense officials are, quote, unwilling to come to grips with the scale of the U.S. obligation in post-war Iraq. This as thousands of Iraqi Muslims marched through the streets of Baghdad today demanding that the U.S. troops withdraw from the country. One banner from the crowd read in English, "Saddam and America are two faces of the same coin." Among other things, protesters are angry over the U.S.-conducted body searches of women. Correspondent Fariba Nawa reports from Baghdad.
"70% of the 500 girls at the Risala Secondary School are attending classes a week before their yearly exams. They come despite their fear of being snatched by armed gangs and kidnappers. Wasan Adil, 17, is a junior here.
When I'm in the car, I was very afraid. Any car which passed through from us, we are scared of this. For any time, I waiting that someone will open the door and kidnap me."
Police and aid workers say there are no verified cases of any girls being kidnapped, but the fear has spread rapidly, alarming Baghdad residents. George Keel, spokesman for the United Nations Children's Fund.
"With the fall of Baghdad, there were reports about children, particularly girls, being abducted. And although we don't have any proof of these abductions having taken place, it's a rumor that has managed to work its way through the community right across the country. And we have people now who are petrified of sending their children to school. They're worried that their children will be abducted either on their way to school or at the schools themselves. We have parents who take their kids to school and then sit out in front of the school and wait for the school to end, so they're there all day in the sun waiting to take their children home again. And a lot of families are just not even sending their daughters to school."
The few missing cases of girls authorities are investigating seem to be runaway incidents. UNICEF looked into one case of a missing 16-year-old and found conflicting stories about her motives to leave home. The U.S.-led forces responsible for improving security are not getting involved in this issue. Iraqis say the fear of girls being abducted is greater than boys, because if they are raped, their family honor is at stake. Educators complain that these fears are hindering girls' schooling. One out of three girls attended school before the Americans occupied Iraq, but now that number has even dwindled. It's noon when school ends, and Faris Mamou sits in his car in front of the Special Honors Secondary School waiting for his 13-year-old daughter to come out. Before the U.S. came, he used to send his daughter on a bus. Now he picks her up daily in his car.
"We are waiting for the safety. Best thing, we need to be safe. After that, everything will go on. First of all, we need to save."
For Free Speech Radio News, this is Fariba Nawa in Baghdad.
The failure of British and American forces to find weapons of mass destruction in Iraq has raised questions about the reliability of the intelligence information used to justify the war. In addition, a British newspaper claims that Secretary of State Colin Powell and British Foreign Secretary Jack Straw also had doubts about the strength of the American case against Saddam Hussein. Gareth Schweitzer reports from Washington.
As the fruitless hunt for Iraqi weapons of mass destruction has continued, questions about the intelligence evidence used to justify the war in Iraq have increased in both scope and volume. The Guardian newspaper of London has reported that Colin Powell and Jack Straw met the day before Powell's February 5th speech before the United Nations, and both expressed doubts about the validity of intelligence information Powell was about to present. No transcript of the alleged conversation is currently available, and both the White House and Downing Street categorically deny that such a conversation took place. But this is the second time the validity of intelligence information has been publicly questioned after the British government was accused of plagiarizing parts of their intelligence dossier on Iraq from university papers in February. The new allegations come at a time when the Bush administration is facing increasing pressure to justify their claims that Saddam posed an imminent threat to both the United States and Iraq's neighbors in the Middle East. Congressman Alcee Hastings of Florida, a member of the House Select Intelligence Committee, believes the administration may have selectively used intelligence data to prove their predetermined conclusion on Iraq's weapons programs.
I'm one of those people who believe that it would be appropriate for us to investigate whether there was a massive intelligence failure or whether the administration did data mining, and that means, the way I interpret it, that they went to the intelligence community with a conclusion, and the intelligence community gave them information that they took bits and pieces of and came out with an analysis that they wanted for themselves. I find that repugnant, and I think this entire administration's pattern of deception needs to be looked at actively by the House and the U.S. Senate.
President Bush has claimed that the presence of two supposed mobile bioweapons labs is conclusive evidence to support Powell's claims at the United Nations. But the trailers the president spoke of were largely empty and have not quelled a push from members of both parties for a congressional investigation into the administration's intelligence claims prior to the war. Democrat Rush Holt of New Jersey, also a member of the House Intelligence Committee, believes the time has come for a congressional inquiry.
If it turns out that, well, we didn't quite know what we were doing, it's a major intelligence failure, and I would say probably a major policy mistake.
No hearings have yet been scheduled, although Senate Intelligence Committee Chairman John Warner, a Republican, has hinted that he also believes such hearings will soon take place. In Washington, D.C., for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Gareth Schweitzer.
The Israeli military today closed down the city of Ramallah and imposed a curfew in response to what they called security concerns. This is Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas is calling for the full Israeli withdrawal from the West Bank and Gaza Strip, as reports have emerged today that a Palestinian National Guard officer was shot in the head and killed by the IDF as he sat at a Palestinian security outpost. This is Arab leaders are meeting today with President Bush in his first major foray into Middle East peacemaking. Bush is asking Arab leaders to embrace the internationally crafted roadmap by pledging to fight terror and violence while calling on Israel to end settlements and restore normal Palestinian life. And as Ula Farawati reports from Jordan, the gathering in the Red Sea port of Sharm el-Sheikh in Egypt is the biggest attempt in the past 3 years to put an end to the bloodletting between Israelis and Palestinians.
U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East has been viewed by the Arab public as a hypocritical double standard treatment of Arabs and Israelis. A major reason for that is what Arabs see as the American long history of backing Israelis at the expense of Palestinians. In an attempt to counter that sentiment, President George W. Bush today vowed to closely follow up on getting peace talks back on track. Secretary of State Colin Powell spoke to the press after the roughly two-hour behind-doors meeting between Bush and the leaders of Jordan, Egypt, Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, and Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas.
We are on a path to create a state for the Palestinian people. We have the international community mobilized. We have Israel now willing to be a partner in this effort. We have new leadership in the Palestinian Authority. I think that it is clear that we're moving forward, and for Mr. Arafat to serve as a spoiler or attempt to be a spoiler, I hope will be met by resistance from all of the Arab leaders who are here today, and such spoiling activities will be met with resistance by the international community. But above all, I hope the Palestinian people will see that in this new leadership, which they elected through their legislature, we have a chance that had been denied to the Palestinian people, and what will not let anyone, to include Mr. Arafat, deny them that opportunity.
Bush called on Israel to stop the construction of settlements, something that the Jewish state staunchly opposes. Meanwhile, the key Arab leaders said they will, quote, continue to fight terrorism against humanity and reject the culture of extremism and violence in any form or shape, from whatever source or place, regardless of justifications or motives, end of quote. Bush made it clear during the meeting that combating what he calls as terror was his major concern. Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak.
We meet here to discuss peace, and we shall all live in peace.
Palestinian leaders welcomed negotiation attempts by the Bush administration with open arms. Newly appointed Palestinian Information Minister Nabil Amr.
We can see that Bush is serious through his press statements and promises. His mere attendance of the summit is an indication of a sincere willingness to solve this issue, and we hope that these promises are transformed into practical and concrete actions.
Even so, not all Palestinians are as hopeful. Longtime Palestinian chief negotiator and former local affairs minister Saab Ariqat was skeptical that the meeting will yield tangible results.
The question is, will President Bush propose a mechanism to apply his vision? Will he suggest a time plan? Will he secure the international observers? Or will he give Sharon the chance to escape from his obligations by proposing security meetings and other routine meetings?
The United States is promising to increase its presence in the region. Bush was expected to name John Wolf, Assistant Secretary of State for Non-Proliferation, and a longtime Foreign Service veteran, to head a new U.S.-led monitoring team that will track whether Israeli and Palestinian officials keep their obligations. Tuesday's meeting served as a prelude to face-to-face talks in Jordan Wednesday among Bush, Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, and his counterpart Abbas, where the major thorny issue of Israeli settlements will be discussed. In Jordan's Red Sea port of Aqaba, this is Ola Farawati for Free Speech Radio News.
Over the past 3 days, presidents of the 8 most industrialized countries have been meeting in Evian, France. This was the first summit of the G8 since the war on Iraq, when France, Russia and Germany criticized the US government's decision to attack the country. The G8 were eager to show unity after division over the war and to create optimism on economic growth. Yvonne Zimmerman has this report.
During the summit, the United States and Britain worked to win over the 8 major industrialized countries for an intensified fight against what they identify as terrorism and the spread of weapons of mass destruction. At the end of the summit, members of the G8 endorsed 15 declarations, reports and action plans, ranging from efforts against the spread of weapons of mass destruction to the reconstruction of Iraq. However, opponents of the summit accused them of hypocrisy. Bossa, from the Italian-speaking part of Switzerland, pointed out that the G8 are the biggest producers and sellers of weapons of mass destruction and the countries that most benefit from wars economically.
The hypocrisy of the G8 is obvious. One of the topics of the G8 were the weapons of mass destruction. The ones that are talking about this are the ones that produce them, sell them, and use them. They're hypocrites.
Meanwhile, the G8 leaders singled out North Korea and Iran, making clear that those countries should not be allowed to acquire nuclear programs. This as the Bush administration accuses Iran of attempting to secretly pursue a nuclear program. No country, however, stated clearly how far they want to go to prevent Iran and North Korea to acquire nuclear programs, and no endorsement was made of Bush's call to pursue preemptive military strikes and efforts to seize suspected weapons of mass destruction shipments in transit. Also, the G8 leaders encouraged developing African nations to pursue economic reforms as a way to receive foreign aid from wealthy nations. However, opponents of the G8 summit reject the position of the G8 towards the African countries. Bakuri Diko, who traveled from Mali to participate in the protests, explained.
The G8 politics is known all over the world. The profits of the majority of the people on this planet to the benefit of a minority is pure cynicism.
Last night, more protests against the summit continued. One took place in Geneva against the militarization and repression around the G8 summit. The demo of a few hundred protesters got blocked on a bridge for more than 4 hours by the police. The protesters had demonstrated peacefully against the raids the police had carried out on a campsite in Lausanne and in the Convergence Centre in Geneva, where an independent media centre was based. During these raids, over 400 people had been arrested. For the summit, more than 30,000 policemen and soldiers had been mobilised. The whole of Evian and parts of Geneva and Lausanne were declared red zones where residents needed a special permit to walk through their neighbourhood. Even if the mass media reports focus on confrontations that took place over the past 3 days and talk about violent protests, the majority of the demonstrations and roadblocks happened peacefully. Laura von Bern points out the Turk group's principle was not to put anyone in danger.
We built a barricade on the motorway between Lausanne and Geneva to block the convoy going to Evian. We made the barricade and then left without confrontations or arrests.
Although there have been difficulties around the protests, the opponents of neoliberal globalization made clear that the protests against this kind of summits have to go on in the future. Tazio pointed out that it will be important to block the WTO meeting in Cancun in September.
It's in that summit that real decisions will be taken. Of course, there's also some decisions of the G8, but that's the kind of decisions that are taken throughout the year, whereas the WTO politics have a profound impact.
Yvonne Zimmerman in Bern, reporting for Free Speech Radio News.
On the heels of recent police misconduct leading to the death of two innocent black New Yorkers, outrage is rising in communities of colour following yet another incident of police brutality. Late last week, a well-known African-American journalist was assaulted by the NYPD as he took pictures of officers attempting to restrain an emotionally disturbed man on the streets of Brooklyn. Nayaba Arindi has more.
I was attacked in Restoration Plaza on Friday afternoon between 3:30 and 3:45. After a call went out for 1013 to apprehend a deranged man, and I came through about 15 minutes later, it looked like it was chaotic, OK Corral.
Len Peterkin is a leading photojournalist in New York's Black Press. He was one of the key photographers of Nelson Mandela's first visit to America after his release from prison. He shot memorable pictures of the World Trade Center after its collapse and has been given unprecedented access to sports stars like tennis's Venus and Serena Williams. But when he took out his camera in Brooklyn's Restoration Plaza to photograph a crowd of hundreds which had gathered to monitor the police as they wrestled with an emotionally disturbed man, he was in for a shock. The police started to push members of the crowd, and then one cop turned his attention towards Peterkin.
I don't know what was on his mind, but he wrestled my equipment down from me, and six other cops grabbed me and began to wrestle and tussle with me until I surrendered my equipment and myself. Then they threw handcuffs on me and almost broke my wrist when they was doing it. And they jammed me into the car, injured my shoulder, my hip, my arm, and my neck. And then we proceeded to the precinct.
Peterkin wasn't the only person assaulted. Alan Lamont is the chairman of the Committee to Honor Black Heroes. He describes the treatment of Rodney, the emotionally disturbed man.
There was a police officer who had a baton. He immediately threw this frog up against Rodney's throat area and was pushing in. And this was after the police officer had already had him up against the wall. And after that, all holy hell broke loose.
Rabbi Bill Tate is a leading figure in the Brooklyn community who helped build Restoration Plaza, which includes shops, a college, and a theater. He was also present.
Because of the manner in which the police department is handling this situation and lack of sensitivity, pretty soon it will be shoot a cop and get a medal.
Again, Len Peterkin.
The cops are going wild, and I don't see why the administration can't see that. Something has to be done. A measure has to be put in place to try to deal with these guys. Since they have the blue wall of silence, the 48 hours and all this kind of stuff with the Patriot Act going in, they think they can run rampant in our community and nothing happen. But a change is going to come.
But right now, it's not the officers who are facing the justice system. Two of Restoration Plaza security guards who were trying to calm the situation have been charged with disorderly conduct and are set to appear in court on July 10th. For Free Speech Radio News, Nayaba Arinde in New York.
Today, a Nigerian woman facing a death sentence by stoning has renewed her crucial battle to stay alive. Her case went to a final appeal before a Nigerian court today. Amina Lawal has been on death row since early last year when an Islamic court in northern Nigeria ruled that she should be stoned to death for bearing a child out of wedlock. Mid last year, she lost an appeal against the death sentence, and today her final appeal went before a higher court. Her case has ignited debate about the application of Islamic law, especially as it relates to the rights of women. Samuel Okoya has this report from northern Nigeria.
Amina Lawal has been on death row since March last year when an Islamic court in northern Nigeria condemned her to death by stoning after she was found guilty of bearing a child out of wedlock. Amina's attempt to stay alive was dashed when an Islamic appeal court upheld the death sentence. As she heads for a higher appeal court, the traumatized lady says she has resigned herself to her fate.
Whatever happens to anyone happens through the wish of God. No one can do to another what God has not ordained.
Her lawyers, who are mainly women, say if she loses the appeal, they will take her case as far as Nigeria's Supreme Court. If she loses the present appeal, she will be left with only one level of appeal before the Supreme Court. Islamic law was introduced in the area 4 years ago. Human rights groups say the rights of women are frequently violated under the law. Men are set free for the same offense for which women are condemned to death. Amina Lawal's case is a classic example. While she is on death row, the man that was charged with her for committing adultery was set free. Several women's groups have taken up the struggle for the rights of women like Amina, who have received harsh sentences under Islamic law. One such group is the Women's Rights Advancement and Protection Alternative, RAPA. The group is in the forefront of the struggle to save Amina's life. Head of the group, Saudatu Madi, says the struggle is to stop the harsh sentences handed down on women by judges whose interpretation of the Islamic law is faulty.
All that women groups like mine are doing is to ensure that the law is applied as it is ordained by the Creator. And once that is done, we know quite a number of the things that women may fall pitfall to because of so many other extraneous factors.
But some hardline Muslim groups strongly support the sentences handed down by the Islamic courts. This include the Hizbas, a group of vigilante youths who police the people to ensure compliance with the Islamic law. In Funtua, northern Nigeria, where Amina lives, I asked the local Hizba members whether they will take part in stoning her to death if she loses her appeal. We shall stone her, we shall stone her, was their response. They said stoning her to death is very much in line with Islamic law. Amina Lawal has become the symbol of the conflict between women's rights activists and extreme Muslims like the Hizbas, who want her stoned to death. The outcome of her appeal will be crucial for either side. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Funtua, northern Nigeria.
This is Free Speech Radio News. I'm Deepa Fernandez.